But today we're finishing up Matthew chapter 20, and really this is working to kind of round out chapters 19 and 20, where Jesus is en route, right? So he has left Galilee up in the north, and he's working his way intentionally towards Jerusalem, where he will go to the cross, he will suffer, he will die, he will be buried, and he will be resurrected. And this event in that we're going to look at in verses 29 through 34, it follows in Matthew 20, it follows Jesus' parable about the master of a vineyard who goes out and hires laborers, right, throughout the day. And at the end of the day, he pays them all one denarius, and there's a little bit of griping about that. And then the disciples, James and John, with their mother come, and she asks Jesus for these two seats of authority for her boys in his kingdom. And Jesus reiterates that the upside-down nature of the kingdom, that leadership in God's kingdom looks like service. It's serving. It's servant leadership. It's not gaining and consolidating power and authority and lording it over people like the authority we see in the world. And then we have this bookend in verses 29 through 34 that is back to another healing miracle. It's the last healing miracle recorded in Matthew's gospel. There's parallels in Mark chapter 10 and Luke chapter 18, and it kind of gives us a fuller picture of the whole. And so I'll reference both of those. They won't always be on screen for you, but we're going to look at why this event at the end of Jesus's ministry before, as we walk into chapter 21 next week, we enter the last week of Jesus's life, right? And so this is kind of the culmination of Jesus's ministry outside of this concentrated effort now to go to the cross. So Matthew chapter 20, verses 29 through 34, says, as they went out of Jericho, a great crowd followed him. And behold, there were two blind men sitting by the roadside. And when they heard that Jesus was passing by, they cried out, Lord, have mercy on us, son of David. And the crowd rebuked them, telling them to be silent. But they cried out all the more, Lord, have mercy on us, son of David. And stopping, Jesus called them and said, what do you want me to do for you? They said to him, Lord, let our eyes be opened. And Jesus, in pity, touched their eyes, and immediately they recovered their sight and followed him. Now, the three Gospels that record this event, Matthew is the only one that has two blind men instead of one. It's not that the other two, it's not that they're in disagreement with each other, but we're going to talk a little bit more towards the end why I think Matthew has two and the others have one. In Mark's gospel, in Mark chapter 10, verse 46, Mark is the only one of the three gospel writers who names one of the blind men. He's a guy named Bartimaeus. And we'll circle back around and go, why is that significant that Mark names him and nobody else does? But what we have is these two blind men in this old city of Jericho. It's not the same exact city that the Israelites walked around seven times and the walls fell down. Later on, the Israelites rebuilt it kind of next to it. And anyway, there's a whole story behind that. We won't go into it. But the point of this is Jesus is incrementally getting closer to Jerusalem, and Jericho is this last stop before he enters in. So next week, you're going to think that we're way out of whack on our calendar, because next week we'll be looking at Palm Sunday, and you're like, that was 2 months ago. And as he comes to Jericho, and again, depending on which of the gospel writers you read, it's either as he's going to Jericho or as he's leaving Jericho. But the point is, in Jericho, there are these two blind men. There's a great crowd following Jesus. In the same way, in chapter 19, when Jesus left Galilee, there's a great crowd. Everywhere he's going, great crowds. Even as he leaves Galilee and moves closer to Jerusalem, there's a great crowd following him. And there's two blind men sitting on the side of the road. Now, you know, that might seem kind of weird to you, but have you ever wondered what are they doing on the side of the road? Right? Normally, like, we would probably tell blind people not to play in the street. But there are two blind men sitting on the roadside, and what they are doing, more than likely, is they are doing what is their livelihood. They are begging. The other gospel authors actually tell us there's a blind man that's begging on the side of the road. He's probably not sitting in a really cushiony chair. He's probably sitting on a mat on the ground. And his livelihood depends on people giving him something, anything. And that might seem kind of weird to us because in our day and age, there are all kinds of services, there are all kinds of helps for people who have disabilities. But in biblical times and in much of the developing world, it is still this way, that the only means by which somebody can earn money if they have a disability is through begging. And it's looked upon as that's a legitimate livelihood compared to if you and I, if we were able-bodied, if we were begging, they'd say, go get a job. In the same way that you and I would probably do that. But in the developing world, like when we lived in Senegal, this is a normal thing, that people would walk blind people around, and it was an acceptable practice. So you have Bartimaeus and this other guy that are on the side of the road doing what they do probably every day in the same place. And the people from Jericho are probably well familiar with these two guys because they're always begging in the same place. And again, when we lived in West Africa, the same beggars are set up in the same place all the time. You get to start to build relationships with them. You know them. You see them and you go, that's kind of weird on a day that they're not where they normally are, right? And so they have these two guys that are on the side of the road doing what they always do, begging by necessity, which means that they are probably not from really wealthy families. They've probably been there if they're from Jericho, much of their life has been spent in this same place, begging from the same people or people passing by their city. Now, can you just imagine? I know this is hard if you're used to seeing things every day. But can you imagine if you were one of these blind guys and you hear the same sounds or similar sounds every day? You know the sounds of your city. In the same way, you and I know the sounds of our neighborhoods. Like when you lay your head down at night, you kind of know what sounds are familiar, right? And the sounds that are unfamiliar are the sounds that pique your interest and go, something's not normal, or something out of the ordinary is happening. Has anything like that happened this week? Where something out of the ordinary happened for hours after you are used to going to bed, right? And you go, and you knew it was on the calendar, so it wasn't a big surprise to you. But can you imagine if you just dropped into America for the very first time on July 3rd, or maybe July 1st, and you slept through the night, and it was quiet, and it was wonderful. And then on the 4th of July, holy buckets, it all lets loose. You would go, what in the world is going on? Now imagine in the same scenario, right? You're one of these guys who is in the same place, cannot see anything, but you are well familiar with everything that you hear and interact with. But on this day, there is a huge crowd of people. You've been in a crowd of people before. You know how the volume is different than when you're sitting in your living room having coffee with a friend, right? If a great crowd of people showed up outside of your living room during your normal coffee time, you would immediately say what? What in the world is going on? Like, have you ever been to the same place and all of a sudden you see a great mass of people and you don't just drive by that place and go, it's just Tuesday, right? You go, what is going on that there are people there today? Even in a small place like Libya, if a great crowd of people show up in one location in Libya and you drive through, you go, did I miss something? Have you ever been there? So you can imagine the noise and the commotion of all of these people, the excitement in the air that Jesus is passing through. And these two guys begin to ask the people around them, and imagine they're sitting on the ground and people are brushing past them. And you just imagine like they're pulling on people's coats. Hey, what's going on? What is happening? They can't see. Like, and I think sometimes we read this and we go, yeah, blind people can't see. But can you imagine how disconcerting that would be? Like all of a sudden, like if you're used to personal space and now people are pushing around you and you're on the ground and they're walking and they begin to ask the question, what's happening? What's going on? The other gospel writers kind of key us in on it. So they ask, what's happening? And now they say, when they found out, when they hear that Jesus is passing by, they begin to cry out, Lord, have mercy on us, Son of David. Now, again, you and I might read that from our nice little place where we've read this multiple times and go, yeah, that sounds about right. That's what you would do. Have you ever been in a situation where somebody yells at the inappropriate time or yells something that you're not expecting? I'm going to tell on myself. I like sports, but I'm not well versed in all sports. So when I was in college, our at the University of Utah, our gymnastics team was really good. They're still really good. Like, they finish in the top of the nation like every year. As the first gymnastics meet I ever went, I had some friends that were going to say, "Hey, we should go to the gymnastics meet." I was like, "That's cool." So I'm walking down, and I don't know the rules and the etiquette of gymnastics. I know a lot better now. My girls would probably slap me if they were with me. But we go in, we sit down, and during gymnastics, while people are doing their routines, it's pretty quiet. And then, like, when they're done, you're like, yay, right? Well, so I sit down, and like 10 rows in front of me, I see another friend that I was not expecting to be there. And I said, "Hey, Danny." And I hear, I can't say this was all my fault, but I hear, "Oh, one of the gymnasts fell off of their apparatus." I didn't get taken out. I didn't, like, nobody yelled at me, but I immediately went, that was not the time or place to yell at my friend Danny and say, "Hey." And I'm sure, because I shrunk, you know, I made myself small, but I imagine that there were looks going like, "What a knucklehead." Now these two guys begin to cry out. In the midst of the crowd, they just speak, like, can you, like, the idea of crying out is not, "Hey, Jesus, Jesus." They are crying out, "Lord, have mercy on us, son of David." I'm really sorry, Mr. Minor, and everybody else who's got hearing aids, sorry. They let loose, pleading, crying out at the top of their lungs, "Have mercy on us." And now they say three things about Jesus that has, like, if we're paying attention through the Gospel of Matthew, they've just made a packed statement about who Jesus is that many throughout the Gospel of Matthew have missed. First of all, they identify him as Lord, the one who is in control, the one who has authority, their master. Now there are many people who would say teacher or whoever you are, but they don't identify Jesus as Lord. They cry out to him for mercy. Now, in order to ask mercy from someone, you are requiring that person to have control over the situation that you are asking them to exercise mercy in. Right? If you leave today and you blow through the stop sign, it's just right down here, and hopefully they don't have the speed trap today or the thing set up. They've done that before, and like a bunch of you came in like, "I got pulled over for a rolling stop sign. I didn't keep a list, but I know it happened." Tim, hey, there you go. You blow through that stop sign. The police officer gives you a ticket today. It would do you absolutely no good to drive back to the church and say, "Pastor Zane, have mercy on me. I had a speeding ticket." And I say, "Well, that was dumb." "No, that'd probably be nicer. Like, did you blow through the stop sign again?" I'm like, "Yeah." I'm like, "Well, I don't have any control to release you from that. So it would be ridiculous of you to ask me to have mercy on you." Now, the appropriate time to plead for mercy, there would probably be two places during this scenario, right? The first place would be to the police officer who pulled you over, and you begin to let the waterworks flow, and, "Oh, I'm so sorry," right? Pleading for mercy, which is the right place and time to do that because he has the authority to say, "Go ahead and go. I'm not holding you to that." The second place would be after he's given you the ticket and you contest it and you go to jail, and then you let the waterworks go in front of a judge and, "Please have mercy on me." In both of those cases, that individual has the ability to release or to fix what you are asking them to fix. So when these two blind guys are crying out at the top of their lungs, "Lord, have mercy on us," what they are crying out for, they are putting on to Jesus and a declaration of faith in some regards that what they are asking for from him, he is able to do for them. That's a lot packed into, "Lord, have mercy on us." And then they say, "Lord, have mercy on us, son of David," which is the ongoing theme throughout Matthew's gospel. All the way from Matthew chapter 1, where Matthew's the genealogy in Matthew is pointing towards Jesus is this rightful son of David who will establish the kingdom of heaven. So they have the Lord who is in control of all things, the one who has the ability to control their situation, and the one who is rightly ushering in the kingdom of heaven. In one simple thing that they keep crying out over and over again. And notice what the response from the crowd is. They rebuke the blind men and command them to be silent. Now imagine, again, different, just drop this into a place that this would maybe make, because you go, at first you go, that seems like a horrible thing to do. These guys are crying out for mercy. It'd be a horrible time to tell them to be quiet and to be silent. Again, I like sports. If I was at a sporting event, say I was at the Super Bowl or an NBA Finals, down to the last possession of the game, everything's on the line, right? Excitement is at a fever pitch. And imagine that I'm gracious, so I took my kids with me. And then one of the kids just starts pulling on my jeans, "Dad, hey, Dad, hey, Dad." It's like, hold on, this is kind of important right here. But Dad, I'm thirsty. Just hold on. Dad, you know, you're like, time and place. That's very minor compared to what these guys are doing. But among a great crowd, they're causing a commotion. And you can imagine, people are just, they're going towards Jesus. They're eager to see what Jesus is about to teach, or eager to see what Jesus is about to do. And these two guys are screwing everything up. They're getting in the way. They're stepping outside of like their place and what they always do. They always sit here and they always beg and they always be quiet, but now they won't be quiet and they won't just sit still and they won't just let things happen. So the crowd is doing the exact same thing that the disciples were doing earlier in this two-chapter section, where the people were bringing children to Jesus and the disciples rebuked the crowds and rebuked the children like, he's too busy for that. And Jesus said, whoa, let the children come to me. For such as these is the kingdom of God. And now it's mirrored in the crowd. And there's two guys crying out for mercy, and they basically are saying, by rebuking and silencing them, this is not what Jesus is about. They have determined that Jesus' agenda is in line with their agenda, and anything else that falls out of that, Jesus isn't interested in. So the interest of these two blind men is in abject or contrast to what the interests of the crowd are, and the crowd has themselves convinced that Jesus has the same interest that Jesus does. And they're about to learn, just as the disciples have, the upside-down nature of the kingdom that Jesus is ushering in. Like, think about this interplay between the previous section in chapter 20. I know it's been 2 weeks since we've been in it. James and John and their mom ask for two seats of authority. Let us sit at your right hand and your left hand when you come in your kingdom. Two seats of prominence. Two seats of authority that they're requesting. And in contrast to that, you have two men who are sitting two seats in abject humility. And Jesus asks of them the same question he asked of James and John's mother. It says that she brought a request and Jesus asked her, "What do you want?" Now Jesus calls these two blind men and says, "What do you want? What do you want me to do for you?" Now, holding in the background of your mind, when James and John and their mother asked for those two seats of authority, Jesus said, "That's not mine to give." In other words, if this was prayer, this answer would be no. Jesus, can we have this? No. But this is what you're going to do. Now, these two guys come with the same question, and if we're reading it in a straight line, what we would expect after Jesus has just told James and John no, we might would expect that would be the same answer that these two blind men receive. But he asks him, "What do you want me to do for you?" I don't want you to miss the emphasis or the impact of verse 33 when they say, "Lord, let our eyes be opened." On face value, you and I would think and say, of course that's what they asked for. But can I just gently push back against that idea a little bit? I think that's the farthest thing that they would normally ask for. If these two guys, if their livelihood day in and day out was typically begging, asking for their daily income and sustenance, most of the time if someone were to ask these two guys, "What can I do for you?" "You can cover my lunch. you can cover my dinner. That would be great. Giving's been a little slow today. If you could do that, that would be cool. They're beggars. They're normally begging for stuff. So when Jesus calls them, he quiets everybody and says, what do you want me to do for you? I think what everybody is anticipating is for these two guys to say something about the stuff. Do you see how big of a statement of faith this is, that when Jesus stops and says, what can I do for you? They say, can you give us our sight back? I guarantee you, pretty sure, this is a pretty thick limb I'm about to walk out on. I am pretty sure these two guys never asked anybody else who passed by, what can I do for you? Can you help me get my eyesight back? Because nobody else could have done it. They recognized who Jesus is, and that framed the nature of their request. And I want us to be careful, though, because at times this question that Jesus asked them, what do you want me to do for you? If we are not careful, that might become the only way that you and I pray. Lord, this is what I need you to do for me. This is what I need from you. If this relationship is going to work, this is what I need you to do. Or we might reframe it. Instead of what can you do for me, we might ask, why won't you do this for me? Right? James and John could have taken that initial no and said, well, then why won't you do it? What can you do instead? And what that does at the heart of that, when we begin to ask Jesus, what can you do for me? What are you offering me? We are putting ourselves, or attempting to put ourselves, in those seats of authority rather than putting ourselves in seats of humility. We want to identify ourselves as those who have authority over Jesus rather than those who are serving him as faithful dependents on him. They say, let our eyes be opened. And it says, in pity or in compassion, Jesus touched their eyes. Can you imagine this moment? The Creator touches his broken creation, and immediately they can see. Immediately they can see. And you remember the interplay earlier in chapter 20 with the rich young ruler? And that guy left sad because Jesus said, okay, this is what you need to do to follow me. You need to go sell everything you have, and then you can follow me. And then that guy left sad. And the disciple said, then who can be saved? And Jesus said, with man this is impossible, but nothing is impossible for God. And as we flow this out in this chapter, we're beginning again to see the impossible is possible for Jesus. And I think the most important thing that happens in this passage is right there at the end. It says they recovered their sight and followed him. That note is included in all three of the gospel accounts. They were healed and they followed him. And when we bring this back into bear, I think we'll look at Luke chapter 18 really quickly, and then we'll look at why do I think Bartimaeus is named. So in Luke chapter 18, verses 42 through 43, Luke includes a detail in the conversation that Matthew and Mark don't have. So they said, he asked the blind man, what do you want me to do for you? He said, Lord, let me recover my sight. Same, same. He says, and Jesus said to him, recover your sight. But then he says, your faith has made you well. And immediately he recovered his sight and followed him, glorifying God, and all the people, when they saw it, gave praise to God. Your faith has made you well. And then he glorifies God. All the people see it. They give praise to God. And he follows Jesus. Now, you remember that parable about how the guy goes out and hires workers at every hour of the day? Remember that? There's people that were hired at like 9 a.m., noon, 3 p.m., 5 p.m., and then the end of the day is 6 p.m. this guy Bartimaeus is the one that's hired at the 11th hour. Jesus is like, this is his last stop before he goes to Jerusalem. On this side of the cross, this is the last disciple that we see following Jesus before he goes to the cross. Outside of the thief on the cross next to him, which is like the 11th hour and 59 minutes. And one of the reasons why I think Bartimaeus' name, this is just conjecture. It's not in scripture for us to see, but this is why I think Bartimaeus is named. I think he is named because he continued to follow Jesus after the cross. And he's no longer known as blind Bartimaeus. He's just known as Bartimaeus the disciple. But for those who, like, remember that these gospel accounts are written to people who are still alive that remember Jesus' ministry amongst them. There is still opportunity. Like in 1 Corinthians, Paul says, after Jesus was raised, he appeared to more than 500 people. There are 500 more people that all of these gospels could have gone to. They say, that's not true, that's not true. And they say, Bartimaeus, you were blind? Yeah, turns out, but I'm not anymore. Like, you think about all of the interactions with people that Jesus has had through the gospels and how many of them are unnamed. There's a centurion that comes who's unnamed. His servant is not named. There's a ruler of a synagogue who's not named, and his daughter is not named. There's a bleeding woman who meets Jesus in the temple, and she's not named. You see, lepers that are healed, and they're not named. There's 10 of them, and only one returns, and he's not named. You see a paralytic that is laid out down on a mat through the ceiling of a friend's house. He's not named, and neither are any of his friends. There's a ton of people who aren't named. It doesn't mean that they didn't happen. It just means that they're not named. And yet here you have a guy who seems to be just like almost an afterthought on Jesus' way from Galilee to Jerusalem. And it's like, and Bartimaeus met Jesus and had his sight. And what's interesting in Luke's gospel, flowing right out of this in Luke chapter 19, is Jesus' interaction with Zacchaeus, who's named in Luke's gospel, but Bartimaeus isn't named. And what's fascinating about this, if you just play this out, these two blind men call out. Jesus hears them in the midst of a great crowd. He hears them. He calls them to himself, and he heals them, and they follow him. And as soon as they knew it was Jesus, they were intentionally seeking him out. In Luke chapter 19, and we don't have time to preach all of Luke 19 as well. But in Luke 19, it says Zacchaeus heard about Jesus, and wanting to understand who Jesus was, he climbed up a tree. He didn't really know who Jesus was. He was just curious. And Zacchaeus, Jesus walks up to him and names him, Zacchaeus, I'm coming to your house today. He's not crying out. He's not seeking in the same way these two blind men are. And Jesus interacts in mercy and grace with these three individuals in completely different ways, in a sense. But in the end, all three of them are following him. So this really is a healing miracle account in scripture, but it's also a discipleship story. It's a story of how this guy became a follower of Jesus. Not just a guy who received his sight back and then went back to working a 9-to-5 in Jericho doing the things that everybody else was doing. He immediately got up and follows Jesus. And the scriptural reality that I want you to leave with today, hopefully you've caught it. If you haven't, I'm just going to lay it out for you more clearly. There's a scriptural reality that we see in Jesus' interaction with these blind men. And that is that God sees, he hears, and he answers. It's all throughout scripture. I want to just give you two accounts. We could give you way more. But in Genesis chapter 16, we're going here because it's kind of an intentional view of this. You remember in all the way back in the book of Genesis, God has made a promise, a covenant promise to this guy named Abraham. And he promises Abraham, you're going to have a son through whom, right, through this family, through you, all nations will be blessed. Right? There's ultimately a forward-looking picture of how everyone will be blessed through faith in Christ, who comes in through faith. But in Genesis, you remember that Abraham and his wife Sarah were advancing in age and she had not had any children. And so in seeking to help God keep his promise, Sarah says, here's my handmaiden, Hagar. Have a child with her, and that way we'll see the promise of God realized in our life. And so Abraham has a child with Hagar, and then there's this issue between Hagar and Sarah, right? Sarah's still childless at this point, drives Hagar out. Hagar runs away. She flees into the desert, and she cries, like she experiences the angel of the Lord in that place, who promises to bless Ishmael, not in the same way as Isaac, but that he will become a great multitude. This is the beginning part of Genesis chapter 16. And then he commands her, he tells her to go back to Abraham and to Sarah. But in verse 13, it says, she called the name of the Lord who spoke to her, "You are a God of seeing. For she said, truly here I have seen him who looks after me." Now, if we were to do kind of a lottery ball selection of every biblical character, how many would you go through before you said, who said you are a God of seeing? Hagar would be pretty far down the list. She, in our brain, she's actually a villain in the story rather than part of like God's amazing redemptive work, right? She's the mother of the child that's not Isaac, and so... And yet she says of the Lord, when he graciously hears her, sees her, and answers her, "You are God, surely you are a God of seeing. And I have seen him who looks after me." And I want you to see Isaiah chapter 30. Isaiah chapter 30, verses 18 through 22, I think it has some interesting, like when you look at this in light of these two blind men in Jericho. But it extends to you and I as well. In Isaiah chapter 30, Isaiah is not a really cheery time in the history of the people of Israel. Right? Because Isaiah is prophesying to them at the point where they are all getting taken into exile because they have refused to follow the Lord in faith. Right, all throughout the Old Testament is this picture of God cultivating a special relationship with people that they don't deserve, they don't earn. It's just God giving freely this good, gracious covenant. And yet the history of the people of Israel in the Old Testament is rather than responding to him in faith and walking with him in a way that they have promised to do, they constantly are worshiping other gods. They're crafting idols to worship in the land that God has promised to give them and has given them. They're sacrificing on high places in a way that God has told them not to. And in the middle of God kind of spanking his children, if you want to say that, in Isaiah chapter 30, they are getting the consequences for the rebellion. And yet at the same time, God is promising this restoring work that he will bring in their midst. And he says to them, "Therefore, the Lord waits to be gracious to you, and therefore he exalts himself to show mercy to you. For the Lord is a God of justice. Blessed are all those who wait for him." Now, I want you to start hearing this. It says, "For a people shall dwell in Zion and Jerusalem. You shall weep no more. He will surely be gracious to you at the sound of your cry. As soon as he hears it, he answers you. And though the Lord give you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction," in other words, even though the Lord allows you to experience life in a broken world, "yet your teacher will not hide himself anymore, but your eyes shall see your teacher. And your ears shall hear a word behind you saying, 'This is the way, walk in it.' When you turn to the right or when you turn to the left, then," he says, "you will defile your carved idols overlaid with silver and your gold-plated metal images. You will scatter them as unclean things. You will say to them, 'Be gone.'" He is a God who sees, who hears, and who answers. You think about it throughout the book of Judges. How many times do the people of Israel turn away from the Lord and then they cry out to him for deliverance? He sees, he hears, he answers. When the people of Israel are in captivity in Egypt, they cry out to the Lord and he says, he what? Heard their cries and sent a deliverer. He may not answer you in the way that you want. Think of James and John. Can we sit at your right hand and your left? No. You can't do that. but he hears and he answers out of the overflow of who he is. He's a God who sees. He's a God who hears. He's a God who answers. So when you get these two blind men crying out at the top of their voice, Lord, have mercy on us. And interestingly, it says, Jesus hears them, calls himself to him, what can I do for you? It would be wrong of us, please hear this, it would be wrong of us to assume that Jesus is like a vending machine where we say, what can you do for me? Here's a quarter, you can do this for me. There, you answered me, that was great. I am not saying to you this morning that there are not deep things over which you wrestle that you are earnestly seeking and asking and praying over and you have not received the answer that you want. I hear you. But hear this, please. That does not mean he does not hear you. It does not mean that he does not see you. And it does not mean that he's not answering you. In the book of Hebrews, it tells us that we, through Jesus, we can enter with bold confidence, laying out before the Lord, and he hears us, and he sees us, and he answers us. In fact, he invites us to do that. Tim and I were talking about it again this morning. He said something I mentioned the other day, and I hope it was true of what I said. I don't know. The God of the universe sees you, hears you, answers you. The God who created everything out of nothing by speaking it into existence hears you, sees you, answers you. Is our response to that to pull our teeth in order to pray to him? I have to do this. Or is there a joyful contentment that he alone has the authority? There's nowhere else that you could turn and say, have mercy over this situation. When we come to the Lord's table, what we are reminding ourselves of is how he has seen us in our most desperate need. Yours and mine. Our most desperate need is the fact that our sin separated us from a holy and precious God. But the reality that Jesus is heading to the cross in Matthew, and what we are celebrating as we and observing as we come to the Lord's table, is that through his broken body and his poured out blood, he has made a way to fix our deepest need. Overflowing from the fact that, first of all, he knows what it is, he has seen it, and he has answered it by taking on flesh, dwelling among us, going to the cross, and paying for your sin and my sin. So as we eat and as we drink together, we are reminding ourselves, we're proclaiming to one another what he has done for us. I think it was Charles Spurgeon who said, there will not be a single person separated from God throughout all eternity who will say, I desperately asked him to have mercy on me and he refused. There will not be a single person in eternity who is separated from God because of their sin who will say he was not willing to hear me. Now that might be a difference of I might be, and there may be a reality. There was a point in our lives in reality where we were unwilling to cry out to him and to trust him in faith. But now, in light of who we are in him, we recognize he is our only hope. He is the place that we run to when we say, Lord, have mercy on us. How has he had mercy? He has placed our sin and our shame and our guilt on his son, who went to the cross for us, who was buried and then was raised, forever putting our death to death and our shame to rest, giving us new life in him. So as we eat and as we drink together this morning, we are proclaiming to one another that our death is dead and our lives are made new through faith in Christ.